calendar. 02-3208, Chris Gentile versus Board of Police and Fire Commissioners of the City of Madison. Representing Mr. Gentile is Bruce Elkey. Let me just get the lineup here. We're going to have you for 25 minutes, Mr. Elkey, and Mr. Herrick for 15, Ms. Hogg for 15, and then back to you for 5. Okay, let us proceed.
If it pleases the Court, Chief Justice Abramson, members of the Court, I am Bruce Elkey, and I am here today on behalf of Chris Gentile, our Madison firefighter, who was subject to discipline under Section 62.13 of the statutes. There are two ways of addressing, as you know, the issue in this case concerns the relationship of 62.13 and the judicial review part of that statute to the judicial power. At least that's how we see the issue. As we see it, there are two different ways that we can approach the issue that is presented in this case. We can twist ourselves into pretzels or go blind, trying to count the number of the angels that are dancing on the pinhead, or we can address the issue presented in the light of basic principles of government relating to the separation of powers, the separation of the legislator from the judicial powers. As we see it, you can take one of two approaches here, the more complicated or, as we see it, the more simple approach. The essential premise of the argument that is advanced by the fire chief and the police and fire commission in this case is that where the legislature has enacted a statute that relates to the judicial process, to the extent that that statute touches on or arguably relates to the exercise of judicial power, the judicial power, the constitutional judicial power of the courts is reduced. Applied to this case, this approach requires that we parse the words of the statute, 62.13. The evidence and the record made before the Police and Fire Commission in the 62.13 proceeding in order to determine the extent to which the constitutional judicial power has been reduced or limited in the particular case. In this case, the argument is the Supreme Court should conclude that 62.13 in its current reincarnation now totally has excluded or preempted any exercise of the constitutional judicial power. So much for the judicial power.
What exactly do you want this court to hold?
What we want the court to hold is that that 62.13, subsection 5, paragraph I, that's the judicial review part of the statute, where it talks about the responsibility of the circuit court to review the decision of the Police and Fire Commission, and it speaks in terms of upon the evidence, and upon the evidence, determine whether the Police and Fire Commission decision should be upheld or not upheld. What we're asking the court to do here is construe that language and construe that provision of Section 62.13 to be limited to, and the final and binding language of that same provision to be limited to those aspects of the proceeding that are subject to the legislative definition and delineation, to wit, the sufficiency of the evidence and the relationship of the discipline imposed to the seriousness of the conduct that was the basis for the discipline imposed. Those are the two elements of an administrative process that this court in the past has held are within the exclusive ambit of the legislature and may be subject to subjected to an exclusive process by the legislature.
What does that have to do with the what does what you are saying have to do with the certified issue here today? The certified issue, as I understand it, is whether 6213(5) permits or requires a subordinate to raise constitutional claims such as the alleged vagueness or overbreath of administrative rules as part of the just cause challenge in a statutory review of a police and fire commission's disciplinary decision such that common law cert review of those claims is unavailable. That's the certified question. Is that what you're addressing?
Yes. And what we're saying is this. The argument here, my response, Justice Bradley, is going to be, I'm going to have to beat around the bush a little bit to get to it. The argument is, made by our opponents, is that these issues, these constitutional issues, if there are any in a police and fire commission proceeding, must be raised in the police and fire commission proceeding or they are waived. And in any event, even if they're waived, they are subject to the final binding language of 6213(5)(I), and so you can't go beyond that. Well, now, here's the problem. Heretofore, this Court has always held that that legislatively created entities, administrative agencies, such as the Police and Fire Commission, creatures of the legislature. What this Court has held is that the creatures of the legislature do not have the authority, the power, in any final sense of that word, to define their own jurisdiction or to determine the lawfulness of their own conduct. The lawfulness of the acts of the government always are subject to judicial review. And an administrative agency cannot be given the authority to definitively decide that issue.
Mr. Elke, I don't understand what would be wrong with saying all of those issues can go in one case. All of those issues can come before the court in one proceeding, rather than saying you've got to have two separate proceedings, one that looks at just cause and the other that looks through a certiorari action at the typical things that are looked at in a certiorari action, including what you're talking about with jurisdiction. Why couldn't we say that a reasonable reading of the statute, which is, I understand, now been amended, a reasonable reading would mean that all of those things can be in one action?
But there are two problems with that. One is kind of at the front end, the other is at the back end. The front end is, what we're assuming then is that the judicial review provided for at 6213(5)(I) is the review of a constitutional determination made by an administrative agency. And we submit there's a problem with that. Now, I suppose it could be argued that, well, when the agency is reviewing the reasonableness of the conduct that is the subject of its proceeding, it is only looking at evidentiary matters. It is only looking at factual determinations. But then when the circuit court reviews it, somehow the review has changed, and now the circuit court is looking at the legal constitutional issues, and so there's no problem because the agency has only been looking at the factual determination. Well, the problem with that is, of course, that the statute says the circuit court is reviewing the Police and Fire Commission determination. So at the front end, the problem is what you are doing, if you interpret the statute that way, is you are delegating to an administrative agency the authority to make determinations regarding the constitutionality of its own conduct. The other problem, the problem on the back end of the process, is that if you read the statute that way, what you're doing is you're agreeing that the only recourse is 6213(5)(I), and there is no appellate review then. So as the amici curiae point out in their brief, if that's the resolution, we're potentially looking at the law regarding 6213 developing separately in 72 different jurisdictions in the state, because there is no appellate court, no appeals court, no Supreme Court review.
I know there's old case law that says that, that basically says that there is no appellate review. But is that a rule that we have to continue with? It just appears to me that there's some sense to be made by saying one judge in one proceeding could look at all of these issues, make a determination in regard to those issues, and because that's the case, there is indeed appellate review. What's wrong with that approach?
There's nothing wrong with that approach. And in fact, that's the approach that I was trying to suggest in my reply brief when I said, look, what we have to keep in mind is that there are two bases of authority for reviewing the action of the Police and Fire Commission. And in a particular case, those two bases of authority both may be exercised in the same proceeding, a proceeding that is a joining of the certiorari issues, the law issues, and the upon the evidence, the fact issues of 6213.5i.
Okay, but
I mean,
there's no
reason why that can't happen.
But it seemed to me that you'd then have to say, as to the factual issues, sufficiency of the evidence and the imposition of discipline, there would be no appellate review. But as to the matters that came up in the cert part of the proceeding, which has now been combined with the statutory proceeding, as to the cert proceeding, there is review.
Yes.
You don't care if it's two proceedings back-to-back or separated by weeks or two different judges. What you want is the opportunity to attack more than the sufficiency of evidence and discipline and get judicial review on that other attack. You're not asking us to reinterpret the statutory language about finality of the circuit court, are you?
I don't think you have to reinterpret that language. I mean, I understand that the amici curiae have suggested that that's something that the court might consider, but I don't think that's necessary.
You just want a cert. You want a cert proceeding, whether it's in one proceeding with the other or in two proceedings. You want to be able to not have your constitutional and other claims. You want them heard. You don't want them precluded.
Right, and we want them subject to appellate review because that's the way the law develops.
All right, I have a question. Do you have to bring them before the PFC, these other cert issues?
I would submit that one doesn't have to. But you know, the practical reality is when an attorney is called upon to represent an individual in a Police and Fire Commission proceeding, and we're dealing with a statute like 6213, and it enumerates certain considerations, including, you know, was the rule reasonable? I mean, the lawyer would be derelict in his responsibilities to not argue or attempt to present evidence and argue that the rule was not reasonable or was not reasonably applied in this case or whatever. I mean, that would not be reasonable for the lawyer to do that. So as where those issues are in a case, as a practical matter, they're going to be argued.
Did you argue them here?
I didn't try this case before.
I did. Whoever tried it, did they do that?
My sense of things is that they really didn't.
Okay, then my question to you is, when I say you, is your client now precluded? That's what I'm asking you.
My argument is he should not be precluded because he raised those issues in the appropriate forum. The constitutional issues were appropriately raised in his petition for writ of certiorari, which was filed with the circuit court. I mean, one of the procedural ironies here is the writ of certiorari was actually filed first in time, prior to the filing of the statutory appeal notice, and yet the circuit court, for reasons that are at least none that I can determine based on the record, chose to entertain the statutory proceeding first. I mean, it strikes me it was not a well thought out procedure. I mean, ideally, I would submit the appropriate procedure where there are constitutional issues to be addressed. The two proceedings should be joined in one.
In circuit court.
And
what do our cases say about if you don't raise statutory or constitutional issues before the PFC? Somehow, do they say anything?
To be honest with you, I'm not aware that they say anything about raising the constitutional issues before the Police and Fire Commission. I do know that in the at least in the, as you may be aware, I handled some of these firefighter cases. They all came out of the same circumstances. We always presented evidence and argued the reasonableness of the rule before the Police and Fire Commission. We didn't necessarily argue it in constitutional terms, but we did argue the reasonableness of the rule. And then in each case we filed the statutory appeal and the petition for certiorari at essentially the same time, and both proceedings were assigned to the same judge. So in this case, too, that happened. And I believe it's by local rule that Dane County Circuit Court now, in these kinds of cases, it requires that where there's both a certiorari proceeding and a statutory proceeding, they both be assigned to the same judge. So I agree with you, Justice Crooks, that I think these ought to be handled as one. In this case, for some reason, there was a bifurcated hearing. Maybe one of my colleagues here can address why that occurred. I don't know why it occurred, but that's what happened. The elementary thing, though, the bottom line is the courts have the ultimate responsibility to review the lawfulness of the acts of the government. And that constitutionally grounded jurisdiction of the courts cannot be limited by the legislature.
Yeah, well, the bottom line that you're talking about is that you want judicial review and you want the appellate courts to be involved, not simply the circuit court in other words, if we combine the issues, you want those to come all the way up to the, to have the proper review process.
Yes.
If I understand the argument.
Yes. Okay. That's correct. And I think it has to be that way, because it's lawyers are, you know, we're trained to, you know, look at things in sort of a sophisticated way, and you know, people make jokes about how lawyers can see issues where nobody else sees issues. But the fact is, this is a situation where the two processes overlap. But the fact that they overlap does not mean that one or the other is somehow degraded or reduced in its effect. And what we're saying is, to the extent that there may be a legislatively provided process, the court certainly, and this court has held, the courts will defer to that process to the extent it does not reduce the constitutional power of the courts. And the constitutional power of the courts, again, is the power to review the acts of the government. And that's a power that cannot be preempted or somehow diminished by legislature.
We don't have to even get to that very grand argument about separation of powers, though, if we simply reaffirm what we've said before, which is that there are two vehicles for review of PFC determinations. One is the statutory review provided by the statute, and that's confined to certain mainly fact-based issues as prescribed in the statute. And there's also common law certiorari pursuant to the Kaskowski case for errors of law and errors of jurisdiction. And we reaffirmed that very basic principle just a few months ago, last summer, in the DWD versus City of Madison case. So we don't have to address those big picture issues. We can simply resort to what we've already said, which is that this common law certiorari has always been and remains available to obtain judicial review, including up on through the appellate courts, of legal errors and jurisdictional errors on the part of the agency. Statutory fact-based errors stop at the circuit court. That's the end of the line for purposes of statutory review. But the law as it stands now is that common law certiorari still is available for legal errors, which is, you know, a constitutional argument is an argument of law.
I believe I agree with you 100%. The only problem is my opponents here are arguing otherwise. They are saying that the statutory authority of the circuit court, because it involves the review of the PFC's decision regarding the reasonableness of a rule that has been applied in a particular case, that because the PFC looked at the reasonableness question, because the reasonableness question could have encompassed, in theory or in fact, the issue of the vagueness and overbreadth of the rules that are in question here. Therefore, that review preempts the judicial power. That's their argument. I don't agree with it. I think I agree with you, but am I missing something?
No, I think you do.
All of these things were that these are wonderful grand arguments, but I think everybody's overthinking it, was my reaction. You know, we've got long-standing case law that says there's two ways to get these decisions reviewed, depending upon what the nature of the argument is. If your challenge is to the facts and good cause, you got your statutory review, that stops at the circuit court, end of the line. If you're alleging a legal error or a jurisdictional error on the part of the agency, you pursue common law certiorari. You can do both, and the better practice would be to combine them. But your end of the line is going to come in the circuit court for fact-based arguments, but legal arguments can be pursued by way of common law certiorari and jurisdictional arguments, and that those can go up to the appellate courts.
That's my understanding.
Mr. Elke, you submitted a brief, amicus curiae, in City of Madison versus Department of Workforce Development.
The Wagner case. Mm-hmm.
262, yeah. Was second 652. I didn't go back to see what your position was in that case, but I'd suggest you consult it. Not your position, the case.
Okay.
I think in reviewing that case, there's some language, and I guess I'll be asking your opposing counsel, that seems to stand for the premise that you're advancing. And, of course, this is a recent case, so I'm just letting you know I'm going to be asking you about that. It's cited in your briefs. So, as to legislative history, if you one of the premises advanced by your opposing counsel is that the change in the statutory scheme that was brought about in the 1993-94 legislature some way changed the scope of review for PF, for the commissions here, the Police and Fire Commission. Have you had an opportunity to look at all at the legislative history? Is there any insight to be garnered from a review of that?
First of all, I'm into my yellow light here, Justice.
About 4 more questions.
Okay. We did look at the legislative history, and I believe the reason no one has cited the legislative history is that there really is no material. There's no significant legislative history.
If there's nothing mentioned in the legislative history, is there? Sometimes I would think that if you were changing the scope of review and changing the what has been understood as the scope of review for years, that if that were being accomplished in a bill, that maybe that would be mentioned in its legislative history.
I would think so, too. I mean, my reading of it, this is my reading of it, it's based on just reading the language of the statute. What I would draw, the conclusion I would draw from the change in the language of the statute is that, in fact, the legislature intended to limit the scope of the PFC's consideration and correspondingly limit the scope of the judicial review. And as I've said in my brief several times, I mean, the difference between a procedure where the circuit court is reviewing whether the decision as a whole is reasonable versus whether it is reviewing a decision, one part of which, the application of a rule, is reasonable, is legally insignificant, that there was no significant change in the language, in the scope of the application of the statute. If anything, there was somewhat of a reduction in the considerations that the Police and Fire Commission were to consider and the review that the court was to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elke. Mr. Herrick.
Good afternoon. I'm Scott Herrick, attorney for the Board of Police and Fire Commissioners of the City of Madison, the respondent in this matter, the PFC. And the PFC does have a significantly different view of the matter than Mr. Gentile does, although I think we may be closer to understanding the issues in oral argument than we were in our briefs. But rather than address directly at the outset the position advanced by Mr. Gentile, I propose to refocus on what the PFC thinks this case is about by looking at the statute and the primary case that guides review under the statute. I anticipate that my colleague, Assistant City Attorney Hogg, who represents the intervening respondent, Chief Omeskwa, will review in more depth the related legal principles through the case law. But the PFC sees this case as a statutory case primarily, and I want to lift up to your attention three parts of our statute, our beloved 6213, parent 5. The first part of the statute and the second part were both added by the legislature as part of the same enactment just about 10 years ago, which is pretty recent in judicial time, 1993 Act 53. The first was the introduction of an entirely new subsection, parent 5, parent EM, setting standards for PFC hearings, where before this change, we had a rather naked direction to the PFC to determine if it would sustain the charges before it. We still have that language, but in addition, we have the articulation of the complete 7 standards of just cause. And I won't recite those, but there are 7 of them, and they're in the statute. And that tells the PFC what to do at the hearing. The second part of the statute that is important in this case is in parent 5, parent I. This you might think of as the appeal procedure, of kind of a small version, a reduced version on a pinhead of rules of appellate procedure for PFC matters. And about in the middle of that paragraph, we now find this sentence directing the circuit court on appeal. Quote, the question to be determined by the court shall be, upon the evidence, is there just cause, as described under parent EM, to sustain the charges against the accused? That is exactly the same direction that is given to the PFC, word for word. So the direction to the circuit court on appeal is identical to the PFC itself. And that sentence replaces the previous sentence that was in that place in that paragraph, which said, and I quote, under the evidence was the decision of the board reasonable, end quote. The third part of the statute that's important in this case is the final sentence of parent 5, parent I. The final sentence reads now, as it has read for more than 100 years, if the order of the board is sustained, it shall be final and conclusive. Now, I will come back to that. It's clear that the second statutory provision that I just reviewed, the second change in the statute that I just referred to, clearly alters the circuit court's job on appeal.
What's the difference between reasonableness, assessing reasonableness, and just cause? Isn't one subsumed by the other?
In our judgment, and I might say that I don't like this conclusion, and since you asked about legislative history, and it's not in the record, let me say that I testified against this when it was in the legislature. It is clear to us that this shift in which the legislature reached into the middle of that paragraph and took out the old sentence of reasonableness and put in find just cause, it is clear that that is a legislative shift of policy allocating more authority to the circuit court in comparison with the PFC.
Now, the analysis by the Legislative Reference Bureau with regard to 1993 Senate Bill 66 doesn't mention anything about addressing the scope of review.
I'm not sure that anyone did except me.
Well.
But what I'm suggesting
if
to this.
If we're discerning the legislative intent.
Well, Justice, what I'm saying is somehow all of us looking at this statute have to account for the fact that that sentence is different than it used to be.
But my question remains, what's the difference between just cause and reasonableness? Isn't reasonableness a part of just cause?
It is, but there's a great deal more, presumably, to the seven standards, because we had reasonableness before, and the legislature determined that it wasn't sufficient. And it articulated the standards, which involve specifically directions to review the rule, the anticipation of the officer as to what consequences for violating the rule, and so forth, the enumeration of those seven standards.
The argument is advanced that the enumeration of the seven just cause is just nothing more than a refinement of a larger term, reasonableness.
Well, the position that we have argued in circuit court on every occasion when it has arisen, and which circuit court judges, in my experience, adopt in reading the statute, is that under the old language, whereas under the old language, by comparison, the decision of the circuit court was the kind of decision that we see so many times in a review context. I may or may not agree with that decision, but it was reasonable. That's what the old circuit court decision meant, in effect. A circuit court decision on appeal under this current statute means I have concluded that there is just cause. It is not so much the difference between reasonableness and just cause as it is a difference between the circuit court judge deciding whether or not the PFC did its job, on the one hand, and making a substantive just cause decision on the other. And this appeal directive is now telling circuit courts, you're not just deciding whether the PFC acted within boundaries of reasonableness that you might or might not disagree with. You are determining, judge, circuit court judge, whether there was or was not just cause. And the only excuse me.
I'd like to interrupt for a moment because although this discussion is very interesting, it has absolutely nothing to do with the issue before the court. Because we are not inquiring into whether the circuit court review is now limited to reasonableness or whether it's a plenary review of the just cause grounds for the disciplinary action at issue. That's not what the issue is here. What the issue is here is how do you make a constitutional attack and whether that is cognizable in common law certiorari. And that depends on whether Kaskowski is still good law. And we said last summer in City of Madison versus DWD that Kaskowski is still good law. In other words, that there is statutory review, and that's limited to, you know, essentially the factual inquiries that went into the just cause determination, and that ends at the circuit court, as I said in my questions to your opposing counsel. But common law certiorari remains available as a means of reviewing an agency determination on legal issues, and constitutional arguments are legal issues, or jurisdictional issues.
I need to be very clear about the PFC's position on Kaczkowski, particularly because I think it was not properly interpreted in the amicus brief. The PFC believes that Kaczkowski is not merely good law, that it is superb law, that it is fundamental, that it is great law. It is our single favorite case. Kaczkowski is great.
But does it say that?
Then we can all go home.
It says this. Kaczkowski summarizes and stands for this principle. Certiorari remains available in circuit court for issues not reached by statutory appeal.
All right. So what does that
Kaczkowski
mean in this
Kaczkowski principle.
Case? What does that mean in this case?
It means in this case, and in all cases since 1993, on a case-by-case basis, the circuit court must look at any given issue and determine if that issue falls within the boundaries of the seven standards or outside the boundaries of the seven standards. Remember that Kaczkowski arose in the context of a reasonableness directive on appeal. And so the familiar algorithm of two questions for cert and two questions for statutory appeal That's not the Kaczkowski principle. That's the Kaczkowski conclusion when the circuit court is looking at reasonableness in the first place. The circuit court now is looking at just cause and is determining just cause. And in evaluating what there is for certiorari, we have to do what is fundamentally the same thing, which is to say what was covered in statutory appeal and what wasn't covered in statutory appeal.
And so what is and what isn't?
Well, it depends on the case. Our argument is, in this case, there's nothing left over after the statutory appeal.
Why not?
Because all of the arguments that were raised in the petition either were, and it's not in the record, but I would say were,
okay,
or could have been raised in circuit court under the statutory appeal rubric.
Okay.
Certiorari remains in principle. It's just that in this case, there weren't any cert issues that hadn't already been covered.
So let's go through the cert issues. Just tell me what issues they're raising here that you think should have been covered or were available to be covered in the state statute proceeding.
I refer to them concisely in my brief.
All right. Let's give us your pages.
I think it's notable that that Mr. Gentile has not stressed these issues in his analysis. At page 14.
14. All right.
And I believe they're covered in somewhat greater detail earlier in the briefing cycle.
I just want to double back. That's why you're stressing the change from reasonableness to just cause, because you think that changed the Kaczkowski dynamics somewhat. Okay. All right. So the first one is page 14, unconstitutionality. Should that have been raised, any issue on unconstitutionality, does that have to be raised at the PFC?
It certainly does as a practical matter for two reasons. One, that Mr. Elke alluded to, which is it's good practice. And two, because certiorari review is limited and statutory appeal review are limited to the record before the PFC. And so the party before the PFC had better make a record, at least, that supports a constitutional argument. And I might say that, well, you don't want me to say things that aren't in the record.
What bothers me about what you just did say. And that is, if you're going to argue constitutionality, you don't need an evidentiary record. And that's what the general issue is. When you're dealing with constitutionality, you can have an argument in front of the circuit court. You don't have to have any record to speak of other than the statute and the Constitution. So I'm not, at the moment, impressed with the concept that you have to raise it PFC because you need a record.
Well, I believe that it's probable that a disciplined officer's counsel could make an argument in circuit court, constitutional or otherwise, mm-hmm, that had not been made in front of the PFC.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the record basis of that argument had better be established in the PFC proceedings. And in point of fact, counsel make constitutional arguments to the PFC all the time.
I totally agree with you. If I were counsel and I was smart enough, I would make it for the front of the PFC. One, I get it on the record. No one's going to yell waiver somewhere down the line. I alert them if they're concerned enough about what I said. They may, at the other end, impose no discipline or a much lighter discipline because they don't want this constitutional issue to go any further. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why I would make it. But the issue in this case is, do I have to make it or be barred? Isn't that the issue?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So if we're going to bar a lawyer and the lawyer's client, then I want to have a standard criteria rule that says, when am I going to be barred and when I'm not? Because to the extent I can get some certainty, now I has changed over the role of judge, to get extent I can get some certainty, then we decrease the problems, theoretically. Right?
I'm on yellow.
Not red yet.
I think you're on thin ice.
Certainty is desirable. This is a new statute, and people around the state are looking, and I'm just clicked red, are looking for guidance on this question.
Right.
It will seem less uncertain as time goes by and as people become acquainted with the fact that we are dealing with the seven standards of just cause, not with sustaining charges, and that the Court of Appeal, the Circuit Court, is making a just cause determination, not a reasonableness determination. And as the law evolves in that direction, from this case forward, this uncertainty of newness will wear off. We're familiar with it, the way we've done it for the last 110 years.
Mr. Herrick, I have a question. You indicated that you testified against the legislative changes in 1993 or so. May I infer from that that the changes were sought by interests other than PFCs, or were you a black sheep?
Or, I'm sorry, or what? What was the alternative?
Or were you a black sheep who was dissenting from your colleague?
I won't presume to testify as to the color of my wool, but I think it's fair to say that the 1993 Act was endorsed and, in fact, had been part of the legislative program for some time of the WPPA, which is amicus in this case. I don't know the position of the firefighters' union on the bill at that time.
Well, if these legislative changes were sought by labor interests, how do you reconcile the fact that if you're correct, they would have been advocating that legal issues be brought up at a hearing, and that they wouldn't have a right to appeal those beyond the circuit court?
I don't feel that any of us understood the implications of changing the middle sentence that I alluded to, the sentence that changed the review from a review of reasonableness to a review of to a determination of just cause. I believe that the political purpose there was to shift the authority from PFCs to judges, but that the implications for review were not fully explored. In my testimony, I warned that there was a problem, but I did not anticipate the scope of the problem at the time, and it is only as 10 years later, as we're discussing it in this argument, that we see this problem of the interaction, the mirror imaging between certiorari and statutory appeal. This is just now being worked out.
Thank you, Mr. Herrick. Ms. Hogg, Assistant City Attorney for Madison, representing the Fire Chief, you are the intervener.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Justices, and Counsel. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant City Attorney Carolyn Hogg, and I represent the intervener, respondent, Fire Chief Deborah Mesqua in this matter. I want to note the position, and I will call my client respondent to avoid the lengthy denomination. It's the position of respondent that the decision of the trial court in this matter should be affirmed, that the trial court correctly dismissed petitioner's writ of certiorari to review whether the rules which petitioner was found to have violated, both after a quasi-judicial hearing before the PFC and upon judicial review via the statutory appeal process in 6213(5)(i), were unconstitutionally vague and overbroad. Further, the trial court correctly concluded that these issues were all addressable and addressed within the statutory appeal, making the extraordinary remedy of certiorari both unnecessary and unavailable. The core issue in this case, post the 1993 statutory amendment, is whether certiorari is available to review the errors raised by petitioner, including the constitutional errors that the Supreme, that the Court of Appeals referenced in its certification.
Ms. Hogg, can I interrupt you for a minute? Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, we heard before about the local rule here of normally assigning both actions, the cert action and the statutory review action, to the same Dane County Circuit judge. This particular judge took the action of saying what we've done in the statutory review action is sufficient. There's no need to address the issues in the cert action. Is that what other judges here in Dane County have been doing, or is this a new approach?
I think it's an approach that is new to the extent that the 1993 statutory amendment is new. It is this judge was certainly not alone in reaching this conclusion, understanding what the fundamental purpose of certiorari is. It is an extraordinary remedy that is only available where the exclusive remedy that was legislatively provided by the legislature in the statutory appeal process is insufficient. Practical matter, if you wait to determine the issues on appeal, you'll be in a better position to decide whether that extraordinary remedy is.
I understand what your position is. I'm asking what has been happening in other cases in Dane County. I assume that you've been involved in a number of these cases. Have other judges said, okay, I'm going to look at the statutory action first, I'm going to determine that, and then I'm going to dismiss the cert action? Has that what has been going on in a number of cases?
In all the cases that arise out of the incident that was the subject of this case.
Right, and we're aware there were a number of them.
Yes. The same procedure was followed. That is to say, both actions were filed, the appeal and the certiorari. There was a motion to defer ruling on the certiorari, and the court ruled on the appeal first. And those cases are now in various stages of review at the trial court level. There was a case prior to this series of cases that was before Judge Sarah O'Brien, where the same approach was used. The appeal was addressed. The challenge in the appeal and in the cert was that the rule, both on its face and as applied, violated the First Amendment rights of the particular firefighter. And the judge took the practical approach of trying to decide whether those issues could be determined within the statutory appeal. And what the judge decided was the issue of whether a rule violated the First Amendment on its face or as applied was fundamental to the first two just cause standards and were necessarily decided within the scope of appeal. And so giving effect to the legislature's intent that the statutory appeal be the exclusive process, the court held that certiorari, the extraordinary remedy of certiorari, was not available because the issues were adequately and necessarily addressed as part of the statutory appeal process.
Does that mean
there could be no appeal, right? Is that what? And then there could be no appeal? That determination is final?
That's correct. But remember, these are two separate issues. Whether there's a right of appeal of the judge's decision under 6213 paren 5, and what remains for certiorari review are two separate issues. The issue of whether the right of appeal is required under 6213 paren 5 was decided in 1912 in the Clancy case. And the court ruled that the Constitution did not require an appeal from the final decision of the trial court. More recently, and again in the context of 6213 paren 5, in Christie versus Luth, I think that's the pronunciation, 265, Wiss 326, a 1953 case. And again, remember, we are talking about a unique area of the law. We are talking about a quasi-judicial administrative proceeding and what due process requires within that context.
Counsel, I referenced to one of opposing counsel the case of City of Madison versus DVD or DWD, the Wagner case.
Right.
And you, I think, are the only one that cited it in your brief. It seems to me that language in that case might answer the very inquiry that we have before us here today. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to review that case.
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
Yes, and I'm aware of the language. And with all due respect to the court, I think the situation in that case is similar to the situation in other cases that I cited in my brief, the Herrick case and the Umhofer case, because what happened is everyone has been citing Kaczkowski and the Kaczkowski principle, which is what this court did, without analyzing whether the balance of issues, is it in the appeal basket or is in the cert basket, that Kaczkowski determined was determined under the earlier statute. But the principle from Kaczkowski still applies.
Your co-counsel, well, Mr. Herrick, also indicated that same, that the principle of the case continues, referring to page 6 of his brief, the deeper teaching, that's the same thing as principle, I guess, the deeper teaching of Kaczkowski remains as valid. But in his argument, he said, so the principle remains valid, but its conclusion is the problem. He said and I assume the conclusion was this bifurcated approach. Is that what you assume too or not?
Well, it's not so much a bifurcated approach per se. It turned out to be bifurcated because the issue that Kaczkowski was looking at was what issues were addressable within the scope of the appeal and what were addressable within the scope of certiorari. I mean, one thing is very clear.
Kaczkowski indicated that the issue of whether or not the agency acted outside of their jurisdiction or acted contrary to law was subject to cert. I mean, that was the very issue before Kaczkowski. Isn't that correct?
Well, I think that it is correct that Kaczkowski addressed that issue, but the principle that I believe that the legislature is presumed to know when it amended the statute to expand the scope of statutory appeal and yet not change the effect of the final and conclusive nature of the trial court's decision is the following. Where the legislature provides for a final and conclusive judicial review of an action of a board, commission, or other non-judicial body, the courts have jurisdiction to review by certiorari only those strictly legal issues which were not nor could have been raised by way of the judicial review proceeding provided by the legislature. So what we need to look at is those seven just cause standards and whether the strictly legal issue of whether the rule was vague or overbroad was necessarily encompassed within the statutory appeal. That is the message of Kaczkowski. It was, however, done within the context of building from Clancy to the Heffernan decision, so it was looking at those particular standards. But here what we need to look at is, as a practical matter, could the issues that petitioner raised be handled within the statutory appeal process?
It's not a question of practicality. It's a question of legality.
Counsel. Yeah, it's a question of law. You're absolutely correct. I stand corrected
on that
point.
I don't disagree with you that the threshold determination that needs to be made is whether the argument that's being put forward goes in the statutory review basket, as you characterized it, or the certiorari basket. That's made clear by Kaskowski, and I think that's an appropriate threshold inquiry in any of these cases. But to the extent that your side pushes the edges of that envelope and seeks to put more and more arguments, including constitutional and jurisdictional arguments, in the statutory review basket, which is subject to that statutory limit of final and conclusive in the circuit court, you're going to jeopardize this whole statutory scheme, including that final and conclusive part of it. So be careful what you ask for.
Okay, understand this is not, I'm trying to advance the legislature's interpretation. This is not a personal preference on where they end up.
I'm posing that as a rhetorical question to you. Are you sure you want this? Let me ask it that way. Are you sure you want to advance this particular interpretation? And I'm not meaning you personally. I'm meaning the agency that you represent.
Understanding that way back when Clancy first took a look at the issue of 6213, paren 5, and the purpose it served, which was to have a speedy, adequate, prompt review of discipline, either termination or punishment, of police officers and firefighters, and understanding that this case arose in 2000, that's one of the concerns that I think from Clancy has been shared, and I don't think it's just simply by the chiefs, but also by the subordinates, is that the exception will end up eating up the rule if we don't give effect to what the legislature intended.
Yeah, I understand the purpose behind the statutory scheme, but how is, if we assume that the legislature intended to put in place, long ago when it first put in place the statutory scheme, and as it has amended it over the course of time, the intent has been to supply a speedy, fair, and just mechanism for determining disciplinary cases within these agencies. How is that purpose served by cutting off constitutional arguments at the circuit court?
Well, the arguments are certainly addressed at the circuit court level, and there is no due process difficulty in having them end at the circuit court level. The concern that we have is if they're addressed at the circuit court level in the statutory appeal and they're terminated there, and yet they can also go up all the way to the Supreme Court on certiorari, we're going to end up with two conflicting decisions. What are we going to do with the trial court's decision on appeal that says this rule is constitutionally sound, it is not vague, and that's not appealable?
I'm not suggesting that, counsel. The suggestion is that constitutional arguments remain reviewable at certiorari and that statutory review is confined to what the statute says, which is a just cause determination pursuant to the statutory standards on the facts.
I think one of the difficulties, and maybe this is a damned if you do and damned if you don't, Justice Sykes, is the consequence of what happened in the Heffernan case is what happened in the Heffernan case back in the 40s was that a mandamus was brought to order the trial court to consider whether the PFC stayed within its jurisdiction and acted according to law. The Supreme Court ruled that...
Ms. Hahn.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm going to try and approach it differently. What issues would you say come within certiorari that don't come within the state statute?
Of course, I knew you were going to ask this. But.
I know you knew that. And a response to me saying, oh, it depends on the case, is, of course, obviously unsatisfactory.
Obviously, the first thing that you do is take a look at the seven just cause standard to see if the issue is capable of being approached and decided within that. Looking at the cases, I can say that the Perkins versus Peacock case, which did not obviously deal with seven just cause standards, but found a generic statutory appeal process to have included jurisdictional issues, said that perhaps something that wouldn't be encompassed within the judicial review would be a situation where someone did not timely receive a notice of appeal and didn't get actual notice until after the matter was decided. The Heil case, which ended up being decided at the Court of Appeals level, and there was a petition for review granted before the Supreme Court, suggested, and since the appeal ended up being dismissed by the parties, I would imagine remains then good law, that if the hearing itself is tainted in some Maris type of way.
Hearing before the PFC.
Before the PFC. And in that instance, I think that there was someone in the closed hearings who was not a member of the PFC.
Seems to me that you could say that shows not just cause, it is a taint.
And that was indicated that that would be, a la Heil, a potential review. But I think the best, I'm way over my time.
Oh, you should continue.
Thank you.
Would you continue? The best what?
I think the best position in which to analyze this issue and give effect to the intent of the legislature that the statutory appeal be exclusive and conclusive is to address the specific issues raised by the petitioner and see if they can be addressed and answered within the seven just cause standards.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Do I have a couple minutes?
Yes, you do.
Okay. When I was a youngster, we used to play this. We were able to get this mercury, little buttons of mercury. We probably all have done that. And then you push down on it, it squirts out in a bunch of different directions. It's kind of the way I felt listening to my opponent's arguments. I mean, just one answer just led to more questions. A couple of things here. I think it's in light of Mr. Herrick's statements about what happened when the statute was amended, it would seem to me that one of the inferences that could be drawn is that, in fact, as has been suggested, no one considered it to be a legally significant change when the statute was amended to change the reasonableness standard to a just cause standard, at least for purposes of judicial review. It would seem to me that the inference is nobody thought that anything legally significant had happened when that occurred, and that's our argument, that nothing changed. The standard is still essentially the same. And the comment that there was there's no problem, well, the fact of the matter is there was no problem until the Gentile case came along. And Fire Chief Amesqua and her Police and Fire Commission allies decided to take the position that Mr. Gentile had no right to appeal to the Court of Appeals from the Circuit Court decision dismissing his petition for writ of certiorari. That's when the problem occurred. This is not some long-standing thing that's been bubbling underneath the surface here. The question we're wrestling with today only came up because of that, the decision by my opponents to make that argument at the appellate court level, that the appellate court had no jurisdiction to hear this appeal.
Would you take a crack at answering the Chief's last question, counsel? Can you think of any legal or jurisdictional argument, constitutional or otherwise, that can't be made to fit within one of those seven just cause standards?
With all due respect, I've been around the block I can't think of a single constitutional argument that's not, or arguably, could not be subsumed within the statute. I mean, under paragraph, subsection 5, paragraph EM, whether the rule was reasonable. That's subparagraph 2. Subparagraph 6, did the chief apply the rule fairly and without discrimination? I mean, arguably, those words encompass virtually every constitutional argument that could be made. I mean, the constitutional arguments that are made where an individual's rights are at stake, always in the end, all boil down to was it fair, was it reasonable, was it discriminatory? They're all right there in the statute. If the statute was intended to encompass and give the PFC the authority to decide constitutional issues. It's there. I mean, there is nothing, arguably, that would not be covered by this statute.
So how do you divide it out? Because if we hold in your favor, we're undermining the legislative directive of the buck stops at the circuit court. And you don't want to undermine that, right?
What?
You don't want to push too hard the other way.
You're not under oath.
No.
I mean, you have to recognize the court will not be willing to undermine that. It's been in the statutes a long time, right?
This statute's been around a long time. I mean, you know what my thoughts are about this statute, I think.
I know, but you can go see the legislature about that.
Right. But what I would say is this. Long ago, in the case of Borgnes versus the Falk Company, and we've cited the language of that decision several times, both in our brief and our reply brief, the Supreme Court made this point, that the legislature, with respect to certain aspects of the administrative process, has unfettered power. And it can give unfettered and unlimited authority to these agencies. But the one thing that the legislature cannot do is deprive the courts of the jurisdiction to review the lawfulness of the government's action by writ of certiorari. Borgnes versus Falk. So and construing the statutory language in the light most favorable to the legislature, I would submit that the legislature had no intention to attempt to limit the judicial power of the courts, that the legislature's intention when it inserted that language in the statute over 100 years ago was that those aspects of the administrative decision that are within the legislature's prerogative, the sufficiency of the evidence and the reasonableness of the discipline imposed, those are the matters within the authority of the legislature. Those are the matters that are final and binding. But that the legislature had no intention and should not be assumed to have intended to detract from the constitutionally grounded judicial power of the courts. And whatever the procedural, the process is before the circuit court, whatever the mix or the joinder or the order in which the issues are addressed, the constitutional issues are always subject, the law issues, the issues whether the agency acted within its jurisdiction or within the law, are always subject to judicial review, and that judicial review is subject to appellate review. And that's what I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Elke. Thank you, Mr. Herrick and Ms. Hogg, for your arguments today in yet another Police and Fire Commission case relating to our favorite provision in Chapter 62. We are adjourned for our April sitting. The court will convene in the conference room at 3:10. Thank you.